Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa Aparuta de sangamatasa tawara ye sorvanta bamujantu sadang. So this is 24 hours now you've been the three refuges and the eight precepts and what is the result so far? Well, this is a way of questioning, you know, just not to think that there need be any result, but a way of looking, of a kind of looking inward. And so like questioning or self-inquiry is one way of reflecting on the way things are. Because like in this special situation, some of you are quite new to this kind of retreat or this kind of experience, and many of you have been on many retreats. Then we think in terms of good and bad, or I've had a good meditation or a bad meditation, and we want good meditations, and we don't want bad ones. But in reflecting, it doesn't matter whether they're good or bad. They're good is like this, bad is like this. So, you know, the desire mind, we want to feel good, and feel we're getting somewhere, and that our meditation makes us feel good, or we feel calm. And then if it isn't like that, then we feel it's bad meditation, which we can doubt. We think maybe we aren't doing it right, or we are blaming the people around us, or whatever. But reflecting on the way it isn't is no longer believing in these emotional habits of wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, but in recognizing the way it is. So Lungpa Cha used to say, good is good and bad is good. Success is good, failure is good. And this way we can reflect on this even using meditation as a kind of personal attempt to feel good or be happy. Of course, in meditation we can become very obsessed, or very selfish really, because we want to be under complete control, and so notice how we don't want any kind of disruption, noise, interference, because the more we kind of deprive our senses of a lot of stimulation, the more calm we become. If we can practice a kind of sensory deprivation style, then that of course means that we do get very calm, because there's nothing kind of stirring us up, attacking the senses or irritating us to any strong degree. But in reflecting on the world and the way things are, you know, that the world is like this. It's not, most of our life we're going to feel this irritation, a stronger kind of impingement, loud noises or strong sensations, aggravating, frustrating experiences are normal to this state we're in as human beings, as conscious beings on a planet. Notice the planet itself, the sense realm, is the sensitive realm. And sensitivity implies pleasure and pain, and it's not just pleasure, but pain. And so we need to see that being sensitive, in a sensitive state, being a sentient being, living in a sense realm, that it's like this. It's not an ideal realm where everything is the way we imagine we'd like it to be, but it's like this sometimes. It's quite beautiful, pleasurable. Much of the time, it's neither nor, and much of the time, it can be quite irritating, quite frustrating, painful. So awakening to this awakened awareness, awakening to Dhamma, is what the Buddha was pointing to, was encouraging, this wake up. The one time I remember I was in Cambodia in 97 and giving a talk at the university in Phnom Penh, and they asked me a question about Buddhism being a religion that is a backward religion, keeps people ignorant and makes them sleepy and stupid. Because this is what the Khmer Rouge was teaching them, you know, that of course Marxism, communism tends to see religion of any sort as something that is an opiate, the opiate of the people. And so Buddhism has been blamed for being, you know, many people do assume that that Buddhism might be a kind of religion that keeps people in the dark ages or in the, doesn't allow them to develop or advance. Because many of, say, in the previous century, many of the Buddhist countries seemed to be the poorer countries, the least developed. But then if somebody asked me to describe Buddhism, if somebody asked me to give a definition of Buddhism in one sentence, I said I could do it in one word, which is wake up. So it's a religion or a teaching of awakening. Because that, if you want to use just that word, that is quite a precise definition of what it's all about. Awaken. So at this moment, I mean, we can be sitting here and not really be awake. And we can be caught up in our own views, opinions, feelings, lost in the delusions of our mind. Even though our eyes are open and we look like we're awake, we may not be awake at all. So awakening is a simple ability to pay attention. It has a sense of listening, of embracing, of being fully present. We reflect on the way it is. So just notice at this moment, in terms of direct experience, that each one of us is a conscious being, a point of light in the universe. So each one of us is the center of the universe in terms of this moment. Now this isn't meant to be kind of an ego trip thing, I'm the center of the universe as a personality. But in terms of experience right now, is that for us, for each one of us, this is the center point right here. And over this being right here, Ajahn Sumedho, the center point is here and now from this point. So that this point here is all there there ever really is in terms of experience, and how that includes the world around me, or you at this moment in this time, in this place. So consciousness is light itself, and so that you can see yourself in terms of, as a in this vast universal system that is quite impressive and quite frightening in many ways, and it's so vast and so mysterious. When we look up at the sky at night, isn't it? It can be kind of rather threatening. You see all the stars in the sky, and you wonder what it's all about, and you feel kind of helpless, a kind of helpless, vulnerable little creature on this planet, in terms of just physically, and in terms of our ability to understand the vastness and the wonder or the beauty of this universe that we're experiencing. When we want to kind of understand it in the terms of our desires and wishes, then of course we can only feel frustrated. It's too vast, too mysterious, too much for us to handle on that level of trying to name every bit, every piece, and because we tend to think we can only know something through naming it. We don't trust our intuitive relationship to the universe, a more universal intelligence that we begin to recognize as our true inheritance when we stop trying to conceive the universe or fit the universe into the rather poverty-stricken perceptions that we can create through our language. So in the mystical experience, isn't it, or in this more intuitive intelligence that we're beginning to realize, recognize, and appreciate, then we can turn to the mystery and the vastness and the unknown, not in trying to pinpoint it or fit it into perceptions that we have already, but in our willingness to allow it to be the way it is, to trust in just this moment, to open and be fully with the pure presence, with the pure intelligence, with the consciousness, without trying to pin it down in any way, without trying to separate it, divide it up into parts, particles, bits and pieces. Notice that in so much of our conscious experience, we, you know, the completely unenlightened, unawakened human being experiences life through perceptions of it. So, you know, when we get culturally conditioned, we have a kind of way of experiencing life through a particular ways of perceiving experience, whether they some are, you know, all right, some are really horrible. You know, we can so much, like fear and desire influence the way we experience ourselves and the world around us. Cultural conditioning, you know, is basically, comes out of avijja or ignorance. So each culture or civilization or whatever has its own prejudice, its biases, its particular kind of worldview that can be kind of grand or mean or whatever. But it is a way of perceiving ourselves and the universe we live in. And then we tend to only experience life through these perceptions. So this is like being unawakened. We're merely kind of a conditioned creature, a helpless victim of our conditioning. And that means that we're kind of, if we hadn't had very, very good experience with life, our condition wasn't very good, then we tend to perceive life through even these most kind of perverted or corrupted or distorted perceptions. So then awakening to the present, the here and now, we're learning to, say, let go of the limited conditioning process that we've acquired and open to the Dhamma, or the truth of the way it is, which is not, we don't need to perceive it as being anything, because we're willing to fully embrace it and be with it as it is, which includes the conditioning of the mind, the sanya sankhara, the vedana, and the rupa, or the physical body. It includes sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. It includes thought and memory. But the refuge then is not in any perception or any cultural bias or any fixed position that we can think of or create through thought, but through this intuitive awareness, through an act of faith or an imminent act of attention to this present here and now, in which then we begin to realize the unconditioned. So when requested to give this reflection this evening, then I chanted the Namo Tassa three times, and then I recited this Pali phrase, Aparuta De Sangamma Tassa Tora, which is a Pali phrase which the Buddha proclaimed, the gates to the deathless are open. Aparuta De Sangamma Tassa means the deathless, dwara means doors or gates. So this to me was always a very significant, kind of a joyful proclamation. Because if you're stuck in the kind of dismal world of your own kind of limited view of life, you know, in the kind of depressing fears and desires and anxieties that one tends to cling to and tend to kind of regurgitate into one's consciousness endlessly, then you think maybe there's nothing, you know, is this all life is about? Do I have to spend the rest of my life with just kind of fumbling around with this stuff? Had a moment of joy now and then, a bit of fun and that, but especially as you're getting older, it can become increasingly less fun and more dismal. I remember childhood being a quite happy one up to the age of 5 when I went to school. And that was a traumatic experience. Entering school, entering kindergarten. Never forgave my mother for that. Why she made me go and participate in such a dismal experience as that, I don't know. And that was what was expected, isn't it, when you're 5? And they even start earlier now, I think. That was nearly 70 years ago. No, not 65. But also intuitive, isn't it? There's an intuition, a sense of there's something more to life than what generally is accepted on most people's social experience. And of course religions point to this reality in their own way, and that's their function. A religion, the word religion itself, is taken from the Latin, which means religio, which means a kind of bond, a sense of binding yourself to some convention that takes you to the ultimate, or the absolute, or the divine, or to God, or to the deathless reality. So the all religions then can be seen as conventions pointing at this. Not in themselves are they that ultimate reality. They are the convention that is pointed, the finger pointing at the moon. They are the signpost, the arrow pointing in the right direction. So then, rather than just end up looking at the convention, which many people do, they never get past the signpost. So they never get to the ultimate reality because they get stuck with the convention. So how to use this Buddhist convention? You know, how to develop this convention that we have, which is a very good one, pointing at this deathless, the amatasa, the deathless reality or the unconditioned. And this is how, what in Buddhist terms, what the kind of terminologies that we use. So there's the unconditioned, the unborn, the uncreated. They use the word nibbana. They use the word viraga, niroda, nibbana, anatta. These kind of words convey are pointing toward this deathless, this ultimate, this unconditioned reality that's here and now. So that's why in awakening, when we awaken, it's not just awakening to how I feel or the conditions that I'm identified with, but that awakening itself, as you begin to trust it, you realize that is the unconditioned, that is the gate or the door to the ultimate reality or the unconditioned. So to realize the unconditioned isn't a matter of perceiving it or seeing it as an object, but realizing it, awakening and trusting and relaxing and resting in this state of relaxed attention. Then when the Buddha taught his first sermon, he used what we call the Four Noble Truths. So after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he gave his first sermon to his five colleagues in the deer park in Saranat, he didn't use a kind of metaphysical teaching or doctrine. He used what we in our terminology call the noble truths. So the first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering or dukkha. So this brings us to something that is quite ordinary, isn't it? This is easy to see. Suffering is the common experience of all human beings. So it's just so, you know, whether you're rich or poor, in countries like this that are so well off and so developed, yet how much suffering there is among the most fortunate Americans, you know, we can see it, we can identify it. We suffer even though we have everything we want, we still suffer. So it's not just like poverty or being without or having a tyrannical government or being in a war that is suffering, but even in peacetime, in abundance, in affluence, in privilege, in status, and all the best, people still suffer. And in fact, sometimes because we have more time to suffer. And when you're living on the edge of survival, you don't think about it that much. You just make do and get in and try to get something to eat. Well, we have time to think and to to create more kind of refined forms of suffering and anguish and despair because of our life isn't on the edge of poverty or just basic survival. We have time to be neurotic. It's in interfaith meetings, like in Britain, for example, in people, it's always interesting when a Buddhist attends an interfaith meeting with theistic religions, because Buddhism is almost the kind of opposite of takes the opposite approach from the theistic one. So in Buddhism, it's not developed a theology, and so because of that, there's many questions from theistic religions about, is Buddhism really a religion? Is it just a philosophy? And oftentimes it looks to Christians as a kind of annihilationism. Because if you just use logic and reason with the Four Noble Truths, you can end up with a kind of annihilationist, nihilistic result. Because it's dealing with suffering and the end of suffering. So it puts these noble truths around something very basic, something very ordinary to every single human being on this planet at this very moment. And was obviously the same problem existed at the time of the Buddha, which was, an ancient time, 2,544 years ago in India. And yet the Four Noble Truths apply to our life, just no doubt, just as well as they did to the lives of people at the time of the Buddha. So the human suffering hasn't really changed. It's the same thing. So in Buddhism, so many times people say Buddhism is an ancient religion, and they wonder why in countries, modern countries, they're so interested in it, because they think of a religion as a very cultural thing, as something like you're particularly interested in maybe ancient Indian culture. Well, not many of you would probably be here if it was just about ancient Indian culture. I'm personally quite interested in ancient Indian culture. But I don't know if I'd devote my life like I have to that subject, if that's all there was. But because the suffering or the dukkha was very obvious in my life, it did ring true to me that this was something that addressed an immediate need and an immediate problem. Notice that it's called a noble truth. So the Buddha is raising dukkha or suffering into a higher place. You say normally, isn't that suffering something we want to get rid of? If we're suffering either mentally, physically, emotionally, or whatever, we're just trying to get rid of it as quickly as possible. Take drugs of some Prozac or some kind of anodyne in which we can feel better, feel tranquil, tranquilizers, or antidepressants, or drink whiskey, or do something, smoke pot, get rid of this terrible feeling of depression or separation or anxiety, worry, or just physical pain, physical distress. And instead of just trying to get rid of it, the Buddha puts it into this interesting context of a noble truth. Well, contemplate this. What's noble about dukkha? Why did the Buddha call it a noble truth? And this, this is a for reflection, and from my own reflections on this question, is that it's through our suffering, through admitting, through beginning to understand, to change our attitude to suffering, that we can liberate ourselves from suffering. Because in the Four Noble Truths, the statement, there is dukkha and there is the end of dukkha, and there is the way of non-suffering, which is the Fourth Noble Truth, the Eightfold Path, or you can call it the way of non-suffering. So taking suffering or dukkha as a noble truth, then our relationship to it now is to understand it. In other words, instead of just trying to get rid of it or blame it on somebody or something, or to see it as something wrong with me, why do I have to suffer like this? We now begin to look at it in terms of suffering and open to it, begin to investigate it, begin to notice what it is. We can explore it, we can examine it. And in order to do that, we have to accept it. You know, you can't, if you're always trying to resist it or get rid of it, there's no way you can understand suffering, because you're too busy denying it or rejecting it or resisting it. So that's why in this First Noble Truth, the insight is, the Buddha said, you should understand this suffering, this dukkha. And then this word understand is through accepting. When you accept this suffering, instead of just trying to get rid of it, when you examine it, investigate it, then you need to really let it be the way it is. So recognize this awakening then is awakening to suffering, to the unsatisfactoriness of the conditioned realm that we're so strongly identified with. So in terms of the five khandhas, the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, these five aggregates, they call them, or five groups, or the one translation, five heaps. And I quite like that, like a heap, you know. You don't need to kind of go into it in detail kind of know everything about everything, isn't it? You just have these five heaps, and you say, this belongs in this heap. Five, you've got five fingers, number easy to have perspective on. You know, if you had 84,000 or 84 million heaps, it's just too much for the average human mind, you know, can't cope with that. and of course, when we monastery up in Amayagiri, you know, we're near the city of 10,000 Buddhas. And so we think of Amayagiri as the city of one single Buddha, then one, and then the city of 10,000 Buddhas, that means a lot of Buddhas. So it's a Chinese way of saying a lot, isn't it? Many. That doesn't have to be a precise statistic of 10,000. But in terms of the five heaps, where the five aggregates, this is where we're beginning to notice, like with the way we identify with the physical body. And just like we were doing today in observing the posture, in our relationship now to the body is intuitive rather than personal. And that this noting the posture, the sitting, standing, walking, lying down postures, the feeling of the body as experienced, its tensions, its pressures, its heat, its coldness, its pleasure and pain. This is an intuitive realization of the nature of the body, rather than a personal, sense of seeing that this body is as me. I'm this person, this physical form. I'm this face. So the body then is not, we're taking the person, the sense of it being me and mine as a personality out of it, and really relating to this physical form through experiencing it as it is, as we can experience it intuitively rather than analytically or conventionally, like we do when we see ourselves in a mirror or a photograph, or our identity with our face. And then when somebody wants a picture of me, I can give them a picture of just my face. They don't need to know about the rest of it. You know, if I gave them a picture of my left hand, that would be, it would be more difficult for somebody to recognize that as Ajahn Sumedho. My right foot, probably, it would be easier to... But generally, we use the face as our identity. So when somebody's face is scarred or changes or that, then it's very upsetting, isn't it, to lose that sense of yourself as this person, this kind of face. And that's based on the identification. I am this body, I am this face. But in terms of intuition, then it isn't, that concern drops away. Because we're experiencing the reality of the body as a condition in terms of its weight or its feeling, its presence, its as we experience it not through personal identity, but through intuitive awareness. Well, apply that also to Vedana or feeling, pleasure and pain and neutral feeling. And that we, on the personal level, we want pleasure, we don't want pain. Neutrality, we're just bored with. When we want to be entertained, we don't want to sit in front of a white, blank wall for very long. We want to show a movie on it so that the movie can be very exciting, you know, with a lot of like blockbuster type movies that we have now. It's just bam, 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 fast cars, explosions, sex and violence, one kind of exciting moment, one right after another. Because these are extremes of stimulation. And one time in Amaravati, somebody brought a video of a man painting a wall white. And it was the most boring thing to watch. And it lasted, I think, for several hours. This video. So neutrality is it we see as boring, and that's why with meditation, isn't it, you're moving to a more neutral rather than seeking excitement and say noble silence, isn't it? It calms us down, where we can get very excited through scintillating conversations or through watching videos or television or whatever, talking about the world, that we can excite the mind through just fantasies or images that we create. But as we move toward the breath or relating to the body, this physical body is through intuitive awareness, this is an exciting, this is an extreme experience. So it's moving. It's when we begin to intuitively realize Vedana as experience in the present, then we don't need to have strong Vedana or extremes of pleasure and pain, because we're opening to what is quite neutral in terms of Vedana. So much of the Vedana is never noticed because it has no extreme quality to it. So notice in when we're examining the body in terms of its feeling, its Vedana, then you wear the sleeve touching the skin. Now, I have to pay attention to that because it's not a pleasurable or painful vedana. It is not sukha or dukkha vedana, what they call atukha matsukha vedana, neither pleasurable nor painful. But there is vedana there, there's feeling when you notice it. So you're beginning to awaken to subtleties that you would never notice when you're just caught in the seeking the pleasure of life and trying to get rid of the pain or the extremities of feeling, of experience, of vedana. Then consciousness itself, or vijnana, is an interesting one. Because even though we're all conscious at this moment, what is consciousness? Even in the say in Europe, for example, people are questioning what is consciousness. And psychiatrists and psychologists and that, this is a big subject that people are really, really kind of investigating now, because it's never been really understood very well what consciousness really is. In fact, I've heard scientists or psychiatrists or psychologists say that animals are not even conscious. They can't see, they think that they identify consciousness with thinking, because they think animals don't think. So they can't be conscious. And yet to a Buddhist that is a totally absurd thing to say, because animals are conscious, they're conscious beings. Consciousness is not just, it is nothing to do with thinking. It's the natural way things are. It's nature. So if we limit our conscious experience merely to sanya sankara, or the conditioning of the mind, the cultural conditioning, the self-identity, the limited ways of perceiving, then our conscious experience is limited to just the sense of myself as a person and my, the position I have in the society and the duties, responsibilities, my problems and so forth are seen as the kind of the perceptions that I experience life through. But when I let go, when I don't create perceptions or fantasies into consciousness, then we begin to realize or recognize consciousness is like this. So consciousness is how I would describe it, is universal. It's not a kind of personal thing. And it's not inside the body or the head or the brain. These seem more like radios or some kind of way of tuning in to consciousness. And so it's not like this. That's why we can intuit, be aware of the body, and because the body is in the consciousness, consciousness in the body. Or the consciousness of you that I have now, just through sight, it's not that you're in my brain, is it? It's not, but it's this consciousness through this birth in this form, in this entity, then the consciousness comes with birth, isn't it? As an individual entity that is conscious in this universe, and that consciousness is not has no personal quality. It's not male or female. It's not European or American. Not black or white. Not mine. Not yours. But when we begin to recognize or realize consciousness, we have this sense of a connectedness, of a universality. A oneness that we forget when we're identified on the sanya sankara level of I am the body, I am this person,
I am this, this are my feelings and my opinions and views, and myself as an individual is a separative, isn't it? I separate myself, I divide myself off from the rest of you. I'm Ajahn Sumedho, you're somebody else. So that's a way of thinking, isn't it, in which the division takes place. But as we begin to trust in awareness, it's through this awakened attention, through awareness, that we can realize consciousness is like this. So there's an it's intelligent, but it's not personal. It's where wisdom comes. It's not learned kind of wisdom that you don't memorize Confucius or Plato or all the sayings of the Buddha. It's wisdom available to all of us. It's a universal. It's not a personal or cultural wisdom. So then we have perspective on self, on how I create me as a personality, as a separate being, as a man identifying with the body, as an American, as a generation, an old man. Now I call myself an old man. And people my age, they don't like that. They say, you're not old. But when you ask somebody 20 whether 67 is old, they say, really old. But if you ask somebody 67 whether they're old, they say, no, middle age. It's all relative, isn't it? But these are creation, isn't it? Am I this body? You know, is this body me, or is it just the natural condition of that was born? It and its nature is to age, and so this is just natural condition. It's not personal. The body is like this. Its nature since it is impermanent. Then it as it grows up, and then it ages, and then it dies. This is the natural state of things. It's Dhamma rather than some kind of personal problem. Dukkha then is noting how we create this suffering around, say, identity with the body, or with the feelings, or the perceptions, or the thoughts or memories or the emotions that we have. Our conscious experience is limited, as I said before, to perception, to perceiving things. And we don't recognize or realize the deathless, because we tend to only notice that which we're conditioned to perceive. Now it's interesting with people who have, you know, when you, like in London, for example, they opened this new art gallery called the Tate Modern, and they refurbished an old power station on the Thames River, and they it's quite an amazing place. You go in the Tate Modern, they've got all their displays of modern art there. And of course, it's interesting because we can't figure out what a lot of it is about. And so, people get very frustrated, you know, they because they can't perceive it as something. Some people get very ill at ease if they can't, you know, if it doesn't, they can't see it and name it in some way. But I find I quite like going to the Tate Modern just because it stops the thinking mind. I don't know what it is. I'm quite willing to let it be the way it is. Being a meditator, I don't feel obliged to have a perception and see it through a particular comfortable way of looking at something. So when we have no way of perceiving it, when we just see it doesn't make any sense, we tend to dismiss it or not even notice it. So in meditation, what we're doing is we're kind of awakening to conscious experience as a flow rather than just through the kind of desultory style of perceiving something, whereas you're just going from one thing to another. But you're beginning to trust in not knowing, in not having a perception, but in allowing the flow of conscious experience to be the way it is, which includes the conditions, the perceptions, the habits, the emotions, the physical body, as well as not knowing, as well as emptiness, as well as pure consciousness, as well as the deathless. So as we awaken, that very gate or door of awakening is the deathless itself. That we call the Amata Dhamma in Pali. Now you can't see the Amata Dhamma. It's not an object. Where conditioned phenomena, you can always perceive. It's always, you can see it as a mental object. We call it aramana in Pali. So it, you know, like the sense of yourself. You can actually witness, you know, the sense of I am Ajahn Sumedho and I am this type of person. You know, when you hear yourself, you can actually, you can observe the ego, because you're not the ego, but you can observe the sense of yourself and what you think you are and what you like and don't like. All this can be observed as a mental object, as a ramana. Or emotions, you observe, you know, when you're feeling angry or lonely or depressed, there's a knowing that I'm depressed or I'm really upset. But because you can observe an emotion, that which observes the emotion is actually, you know, transcending the emotion, is not the anger, is not the depression. You can observe the body because it's not self, it's not yours, really, not what you are. So you can, that's where being aware of it as in this intuitive way, as its weight, its presence, its limitation, its pain, its pleasure, its neutrality. Because the body is an aramana, is an object that you're witnessing to, can observe. So in observing consciousness, you can't get behind consciousness, but you can know consciousness is like this. So this awareness, consciousness, this awareness allows you to be fully conscious. It's like opening the gate. And then you have perspective on the things that move and change. The impermanent conditions, the anicca dukkha anatta of the khandhas. So it's like one can compare it to a movie screen. And you have a kind of wall of white, and the shadows on the screen, and can be beautiful, ugly, be exciting, can be boring, whatever. But you couldn't possibly see these shadows unless you had the screen, the consciousness, and awareness of that. So the importance is to be the awareness, be the awakened. Be that which is awake, and in this reference to Buddha knowing the Dhamma, is not that I'm the Buddha in terms of a person, isn't it? We call it taking refuge in Buddha, Bhutang Sarananga Chami, is the way we refer to it. But what that really means in a practical situation is our ability to be present here and now. We can observe the shadows that move, the sense of myself as a person, and the emotions of fear or desire or love or hate, worry, anxiety, jealousy, and all these things. They're the things that begin and end, arise and cease. And our relationship to them is no longer one of identity, but of interest, to see their nature is impermanent rather than holding to them as mine, which gives the impression that they are permanent because they're mine. And that when you think of yourself as a personality, you think you're the same personality all the time. When you're asleep, you're this person. When you're with your parents, you're the same person. When you're at the office, you're the same person. But that's not true. When you really look, you notice your personality changes according to the conditions present. Does anybody asleep have a personality? You know? So in terms of say what your personality is now, is you're observing it. And so the conditions now are such that you're not engaged in as you would be, say, if you were with your family or if you were at work. So you begin to notice when these conditions are absent or when these conditions are present, then the personality tends to be like this. But the knowing is what you really are in terms of your being this knowing rather than holding to the view that you are in any way a permanent person or personality. Because it's through this gate to the deathless that we are liberated of these delusions that we create, this suffering that we create. Now in the second line, ye sotavanta bhamunjantu satang, this sotavanta is one who pays attention. Sotavanta, a listener, or the sense of listening. Notice that when you really listen, you're kind of, it's a broad spectrum that includes. You might listen to just one thing, but say a sort of one that has this sense of listening in this broad way of being attentive to this present moment, or one who pays attention. Bhamunjantu satang means to surrender or to release into this faith, into this pure presence, and really trust this, because this is how you realize the deathless reality in which you then can let go of your fears, your desires, your limitations, the suffering that you create. You can be freed and liberated from these kind of habits, these limitations. So this evening I've talked long enough, and just for your reflection, anything I've said this evening is for that. You don't have to believe anything I say, and you can question any of it. But the main thing is to reflect. It's encouraging that you're encouraging you to reflect on things rather than to just accept or just reject you know, what teachers say with that. I'm not asking you to accept what I say, but to reflect on it. And encouraging this kind of awakenness in you all so that you will realize the ultimate reality or the deathless and be freed from all suffering. So I'll end this right now.
Annamayang o vadagata sa Sadhukaram dadamase. Sadhukaram.